This is Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher at KBOO Radio 90.7 FM Portland. Have you ever been at a rally or an event and looked for or seen the mainstream media coverage? Wondered about it? How it was seen? What you might have done to change the perceptions? Well, today, our next guest, Sarah Soberai, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Tufts University, has just published a book, and she might have some answers for us. The book, Sound Bitten, The Perils of Media-Centered Political Activism, is about this very subject. So welcome to KBOO, and welcome.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
As you can imagine, here at KBOO, this could be considered one of the epicenters of many of the things that you write about in your book. We are a media outlet. We really play to people who are interested and activists. So I was really interested in your perspective. So let's start with how you kind of came to the subject and what your thesis is.
Sure. I studied 50 U.S. activist groups from across the political spectrum, and what I was interested in was finding out how they used specifically presidential elections as moments of political opportunity, you know, whether they were going to try to make political change at that opening, because it's an exciting time. And what surprised me a little bit when I first went out was that I expected, since I had such a wide range of organizations, both politically but also their issues, some were environmental, some were anti-death penalties, some were there about health care or civil liberties, you know, a huge range of issues. I assumed they would take different approaches, but what I found very quickly was it was really a story about garnering media attention, because virtually every organization I studied, 47 out of the 50 of them, their number one goal was to attract the attention of the mainstream media, the news media in particular. So quickly I sort of started focusing in on the relationship between the activist groups and the journalists that were out and about, because obviously this is quite a magnet for news organizations. I was around specifically the nominating conventions in both 2000, 2004, a little bit in 2008, and some of the debates early on as well. And what I realized, the first part, I don't think is terribly surprising, although it certainly is disappointing, is that given the incredible effort and put into trying to attract news coverage, most of the groups fail miserably. They aren't successful. Only about a third got any attention at all whatsoever. And the overwhelming majority of even that attention took the form of sort of local color stories that would lump all the groups together in this sort of snapshot collage that often portrayed them either as criminals or as bizarre outposts of political life, not really as political actors. And I think most activists can kind of relate to the frustration that brings to mind. Less expected, certainly by me, is that what I really noticed was the incredible toll that this media centrism took on the organizations themselves. It drained their resources, both human resources and financial resources. It got in the way of their ability to communicate with bystanders on the streets because they were really focused on sound bites and photo opportunities, and sometimes people would approach them with a question and they wouldn't really be able to answer because they were expected and had practiced sort of these pithy one-liners, which aren't very good at generating conversation. And it really impacted the relationships within the groups because, unfortunately, when you're focused on trying to get a 10-second, if that, sound bite, every member of the group becomes a potential liability that leaders and organizers were trying to sort of control so that they were represented well and not embarrassed.
Well, you argue in the book that the pervasive mediaization of politics has jeopardized the ability of dissenting groups to actually engage in public discourse. What you're speaking about, actually go out and be able to inform the public in kind of a general way, and it somehow reduced it and separated it and possibly jeopardized it.
Absolutely. I mean, I think on one hand, it's easy to take the perspective of if you're going to try to be detached and say, well, maybe this small group that's organized around education doesn't really have a place in the national newspapers if this is a presidential campaign and there's a lot going on. But I think if we stop and reflect a little bit, the systematic marginalization of these voices, which is what I found, for example, when I say systematic, a newspaper, for example, would have a beat where someone's assigned to cover the courthouse or, the governor or something like that. But there is no sort of activist beat or civil society beat or, nonprofit advocacy group.
Yes.
There's not structurally space for that. But at any rate, so I think when we have sort of this huge range of voices that are excluded, we really lose something. And I can, like, one example for example, going way back to
the 2000,
if we think about Kerry and Bush, who were both sort of discussing the war and were, in this sort of, Kerry, if you'll remember, was really trying to sort of assert himself as an appropriately militaristic president. It wasn't sort of war or no war, it was war versus war. And so to have another perspective present would have changed the discourse somewhat. If you were to have the huge number of anti-war groups, for example, to have a voice there, or I guess that's 2004, excuse me, or issues where, like free trade, where there wasn't a lot of disagreement, but voices in the streets were actually bringing different ideas to bear that might change. Many people might not find what they have to say compelling, but for some people it could inform the way they see things, the information they seek out, and even potentially their decisions at the voting booth.
The difficulty, and of course you do address it through the book, and you're talking about, well, what if nobody is watching? How do you, use campaign events as catalysts?
Oh, are you asking me for a recommendation?
No. I was saying you address it in the book, the politicization of the public square. You want to elaborate a little bit on that for us?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the part of the research that I found most heartening was going out, because there isn't a lot of coverage of these events, going out to the nominating conventions and debates, I was absolutely stunned the first election cycle that I went out at the sheer number of organizations present and vocal and committed to working toward whatever their, pet interest or concern is and or was. And I think that what gets missed if you're not in those host cities is that all of a sudden the United States doesn't look like this sort of apathetic TV watching, disconnected public, but instead what you see is this really vibrant, almost festival or carnival of activism
and activism.
Ideas and discussion and passion. And so I found in some groups, of course, I'm a person with my own set of political opinions and priorities, so some groups I, would support, others I found more complicated, others I would disagree with, but I just found the very act of political participation incredibly encouraging and inspiring and seeing that. And so for the public at home who's not in whatever the host cities are, I also think seeing that in and of itself is valuable, to have this model of there are people who are active and engaged in a really physical way with the political process, or they're trying to be.
Right. And on the flip side of that, in many instances, you describe the kind of zero-sum game in which conflict or disruption pushes kind of the information about activists in front of the event. Can you kind of elaborate?
That's how journalists tend to. And I should say as backstory, too, that I interviewed a lot of journalists for this work, and my overall impression was of a serious group of intellectual people trying to do the best job that they could. I'm definitely not someone who comes out of this research thinking that, journalists are, terrible people or biased or, all of these things. In fact, I think it's a much more complicated story. But at any rate, many of the journalists do sort of implicitly conceptualize their coverage, to the extent that they're covering it, of activism as a zero-sum game where if there's violence, And violence could be sort of property damage or actual, you know, physical altercations, say with the police. It's very rare to have it with a bystander, but with the police or between protesters and counter-protesters, tend to see that as, if you're covering that, of course I can't also cover, you know, the ins and outs of, you know,
what the actual event.
Right. So there, I'm focused on this other stuff. But I think that that's really not the case, because it seems to me, watching, that if you've got an incredible conflict, if you've got something where you've got hundreds and hundreds of people willing to be arrested, if I were sitting at home, I think it seems quite feasible to me that that the reader might want to know why someone would be willing to do that. And the other reason I could see, as sort of an outsider, that it's not really a zero-sum game is because even when there's not violence, the story is often about then the fact that there was not violence, which is ironic and sort of almost a cruel joke. You know, it's sort of a story about how peaceful the protests were, or how well-behaved people were and how friendly the police were. I saw stories like that, especially in Boston, how friendly the police were to the protesters. And so it's not as if not having conflict creates all of a sudden a space for real discussion of the issues
to occur. Well, I want to remind.
And I even had one journalist say, from a major national paper, say, "I don't know why people have said that political conflict doesn't work. You know, of course it works. If there's violence, we're going to cover it. The problem that activist groups need to come to terms with, though, aside from grappling with questions of violence, which are certainly worth reflecting on, is that normally that coverage is not particularly beneficial to them as an organization.
To the cause. It's more directed at that. Well, I want to remind our listeners that we are now speaking with Sarah Soberai, who's written a new book, Sound Bitten: The Perils of Media-Centered Political Activism. It's kind of a weaving together of field work, news analysis, and kind of in-depth interviews with activists and journalists that illuminate the relationship between news and activist organizations. I think it's really important to kind of move forward to update in terms of the 2008 election and how you talk about hope and change.
Okay. Well, one thing that I thought was really interesting thinking about 2008 was looking at from afar. At that point, I was doing more online work, but looking at 2008, what I noticed is that it had, from a media perspective, an opportunity for things to be quite different, because Web 2.0, which is, you know, frequently hailed as being revolutionary for activism in particular, you know, it was interesting and had the potential to be a different story. And what I found that was interesting was, again, you know, as we might predict, that it was difficult to find sort of mainstream news coverage of what was going on around the 2008 election in terms of activism, but also that the way the activist groups were using Web 2.0, they had certainly integrated things like Facebook, even MySpace, although now that's, you know, out, but at that moment MySpace was being used, blogs, things like that. To the extent that they integrated it, it still remained, two things. One, it remained very old, what you might call old media centric. In other words, a lot of what was being posted on, say, a blog would be a reposting of a story from the New York Times or the Boston Globe. You know, it was still sort of focused, like much social media, on sort of old-fashioned forms of journalism. The other thing that I noticed is that the organizations didn't seem yet to be really taking advantage of the opportunity presented by Web 2.0. In other words, on Facebook, for example, they might use Facebook as a virtual billboard. So they would use it to announce, or MySpace, or a blog, use it to announce an event coming up, but not for interactivity, which is really
for originating it. Yes,
right. So it was still sort of a static medium, and I don't think used very well, to certainly not to its full potential.
Well, now we need to move forward and from that point talk about the Iowa, up-and-coming Iowa caucuses and how you think that has informed and will inform the next election, and maybe touch on the Tea Party and how they've been able to use it.
Sure. I think one thing that's interesting is that the Tea Party has been quite successful in getting media coverage. And for folks, at least on the left, what I hear people say most often is, well, that's because they've been propped up by Fox and they've had all this sort of free advertising almost, this sort of thinking. But I don't think, though the jury is still out, it looks to me that coverage of the Tea Party has been quite strong in most major news outlets. So I don't think that necessarily, if perhaps they've had attention from Fox, but they're also doing well on CNN and also doing well on the major networks.
And we remember when it started in terms of the town hall meetings. These were happening individually around the country.
Right. And I think the reason they were really interesting to journalists is because I talk in the book quite a bit about this interesting discrepancy between what activists think journalists want and what journalists want from activists. So activists that I studied, I'm not talking about the Tea Party now, I'm talking about the folks from the book. The activists that I studied were really focused mostly on appearing legitimate, wanting to be credible, not wanting to look like a loose cannon radical. So even in organizations whose political interests may have been radical, they often had a spokesperson, had press kits, had a press release, gave, press conferences, they were very, very careful about appearing legitimate or professional or credible.
And I think their underlying concern, we can assume, was that they were fearful that they were going to be marginalized if they didn't appear this way. And in the book, go ahead.
Yes. I mean, so absolutely. And I don't blame them at all for sort of thinking this. I want to find a way to control the representation. I don't want to be discounted as illegitimate, and I want to be taken seriously, so I'm going to present myself in this way and present our organization in this way. But interestingly, the journalists were incredibly turned off by that. And I think that much of what they get from traditional political insiders, like elected officials or their spokespeople, for example, are press releases, sound bites, these sort of scripted performances. And so in their coverage of activism, they are demanding what I call authenticity. They're demanding something very different. So the last thing they want is a prepared soundbite. The last thing they want is someone with reasoned argument or data, God forbid. They want emotion. They want personal stories of pain. They do not want facts.
And that is what the Tea Party did so authentically. And so, I mean, these were people who showed up and spoke up without consideration for whether they were even factually correct oftentimes, but this is how they felt and this is their form and they were going to, be heard.
Well, there were a lot of interesting things happening there from a storytelling point of view. In those town hall meetings, there are these sort of emotion-fueled audience members who are speaking spontaneously or off the cuff. Like you're saying, really, it did not feel staged, which is what the journalists didn't like. Another thing that really played a role in the Tea Party being interesting is that another type of authenticity is just being original, being something really different. And Tea Party activists, by virtue of who they are innovative, because when we think of a protester in our mind, we do not picture flag-waving, silver-haired conservatives wearing athletic socks and fanny packs and these types of things. So initially, they were such an unlikely band of protesters that this was also something that was almost irresistible. And so I think that I think there were some reasons that fit quite clearly, actually, with the thesis that I make that explain why they've done so well. Right. And now, of course, from a press perspective, they have, candidates. And they are, as we're watching now, they have real sway in the folks that they've elected. And now with Michelle Bachmann's candidacy, You know, this is interesting too. Although I, you know, in many ways she is, though she's not an activist per se, she's also not treated as a legitimate political actor by the press. And I think that's sort of an interesting thing to watch unfold.
Well, and speaking of, since we just have a few minutes, I would like to, I mean, there are also interesting moments like the Sarah Palin bus tour, in which it started out seemingly authentic, and kind of imploded on its own because I think it soon became true that it wasn't necessarily, or I don't know how you feel about it, but I mean, it was an interesting moment in time in terms of using the media, who's using who, how is it being utilized, and this whole new movement forward.
Well, I think for me, I mean, I have not studied the way the relationship between candidates and the press. So it's, you know, I'm speculating, and I think that it's probably quite different and would expect to find different things if I were doing research like that. But one thing that I do notice that I think is really interesting is watching not the news media that we think of, not, you know, ABC or the New York Times or CNN, but instead thinking about the way the political opinion media handle candidates like Sarah Palin or Michelle Bachmann. So I'm doing research now on a new book that looks at what we call the outrage industry. So organizations and media outlets where it's news-based information, but presented in a way that's intended to fuel an emotional response from the audience, whether that's fear or anger or moral indignation. And we have these on the left and the right. So there's Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck and folks like that on the left, and there's Keith Olbermann and Cenk Uygur and folks like that, Ed Schultz, on the left. And so we see, as we watch the way these candidates are treated in those outlets, some really interesting things going on. And I think one example might be when Michelle Bachmann announced her candidacy in Waterloo, Iowa. She, as you may remember, made a relatively minor mistake of assuming that John Wayne, the actor, was from Waterloo, when in fact he was from a neighbor at a nearby town in Iowa. But, I mean, that would have been a minor gaffe if John Wayne Gacy, the murderer, had not for a time lived in Waterloo, Iowa. And so the left then, the right is often guilty of this as well, but Keith Olbermann and the left blogs and stuff really went on the warpath. I remember the blog Wong Kett said that Michelle Bachmann, the headline said something like, Michelle Bachmann praises serial killer John Wayne Gacy. Well, this is A, patently inaccurate, and B, a really interesting way to sort of watch how candidates are treated. So I think for me, the more interesting to look at the way candidates are treated are in sort of the left and right.
I know I personally, and many people that I spoke with, went, that's the worst thing we can say about her? Are you kidding?
Right.
What
right.
about every stand she's taken on all the important issues that I care about? That's somehow right. lost.
I think that's what's interesting is that you would expect the left, the left ideological outrage-based media to have a lot to say on the day she declares her presidency, and they had a real opportunity to intervene, that's right, and talk about policy, or even to talk, even if they didn't want to be that meaty, to talk about, I wonder how a mistake like that is going to resonate with Iowan voters, since she was clearly trying to, you
court
know,
their vote, right.
with them.
Right.
But instead, they opt for this unbelievably adolescent, you know, playground level. I know Keith Olbermann called her stupid and said that this was the litmus test for somebody you'd never want in the White House. And I thought, really? Somebody who doesn't know the hometown of John Wayne is the, you know, that's the litmus test?
Yeah.
I think there are better tests.
Do you have some opinion about the next election in terms of what we should look for and a continuation of this? Or will people finally go, as I said, really, that's the worst thing she has to offer as a presidential candidate? What about all of her stands and all of her issues? And yet some of them, again, and some of the digging and some of the, you know, journalism does belie a basic difference, and that also is very important.
I think that I don't know, I have a lot of thoughts. My one thought is that I don't expect we would see a lot of change. I don't expect this election to all of a sudden have activist groups getting much more attention. I don't expect, you know, all of a sudden Rush Limbaugh and Keith Olbermann to become more mature and do more hard-hitting political stories. It's just not as profitable as the political pornography they're currently working on. But I do think that it's the thing that will be most interesting this time is to look at whether or not Web 2.0 does get used in a new and fresh way. And I think there's been so much talk about Twitter and Twitter in particular being this revolutionary force. I'm curious to see what activists will do with it. I'm curious to see what candidates will do with it. And I'm curious to see how news organizations use it. I know Facebook is collaborating right now to put out Facebook editions of some major newspapers, working in conjunction with newspapers. So I'm curious to see sort of how this intervenes in the story. For activists, what I would like for them is for them to, but this is a hope, not a prediction, to invest less energy in trying to court the mainstream news media, not because it's not an important thing, but because there isn't a lot of reason for optimism there. And I think that those precious sort of financial and human resources might be better used searching after sort of a smaller group of people, whether that's door-to-door reaching voters or working to lobby delegates or things like that. I think that rethinking their approach and the way they use their resources would be really
More advantageous.
What I saw during the last several elections.
Yeah. Brief, do you see no difference between Keith Olbermann and Rush Limbaugh in that to have the right-wing sound machine unanswered didn't seem to be a very studious or... It seemed like in that vacuum that there was also, we were always playing catch up on the left saying, but that really isn't accurate.
Right.
And the misinformation of Fox News. Now, I think that Jon Stewart, by going on Fox News and really kind of saying, really, is this
right.
News?
There's definitely a difference, but I don't think, I mean, I have published a paper that sort of breaks down and looks at who the worst offenders are and that sort of,
okay.
sort of information. But I also think that And I should say that research shows that the left and right are both mean, but the right is meaner. That would be sort of the punchline from that. The right definitely does use, even within these outlets, they do tend to use more per show.
Higher volume.
As numbers go up, as the number of what we call outrage incidents go up in a particular show, that show is increasingly likely to be a right-leaning show. But the other difference that's really important is simply that, particularly in talk radio, there are so many more right-leaning outlets than left-leaning outlets. Talk radio is over 90% conservative, and that's astonishing. So that voice is certainly louder. Having said that, people on the left will get very sort of fussy about anything critical, especially about their favorite host, whether it's Olbermann or Schultz or Uyghur, Maddow, whoever it is. But it's very difficult to see outrage as such when you agree with the host. So I think that there are certainly on both sides offenders, and the right, there are more of them, and they are certainly louder. But there are some on the left, too, who should be held accountable as well.
Well, we're looking forward to your next book and hearing what you have to say. I want to remind our listeners that, again, our guest has been Sarah Soberai, and she has written a new book, Sound Bitten, The Perils of Media-Centered Political Activism. I hope that we'll have an opportunity to have you back with us and see what you find out when the next election comes.
Oh, thank you. I would love that. It's been a pleasure.
All right. And this is Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher at KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland.